Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, this is our 200th episode of this here podcast, and Vladimir Putin has given us a present in recognition of that fact.
I for one can't wait to. We should really stop calling it World War III, shouldn't we? Because I feel like that's catastrophizing to an extreme amount. It would have been nice if we, I don't know, had a more positive thing to talk about for our 200th episode. But a European invasion is apparently where we're going to go, Jimmy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we thought, you know, the pandemic was over. This was all going to be chillaxing,
basically.
Yeah, that is
what we thought. Are you speaking for both of us?
That is exactly what we thought. There was no dissent at all from that position. The pandemic was over and done with. Brexit has been a roaring success. It was sunny uplands all the way, I think.
I hate this.
You know, continue as we started, I think, Jazza. As two sworn enemies who do a podcast together.
I did enjoy someone on Twitter said, what is this whole two best friends talk about X format on a podcast? I want to see two enemies. And I think I've quote tweeted it.
You did, yeah. I think we're probably not two best friends, two resentful friends, maybe.
Bound together by a shared enthusiasm for showing off on the internet. There you go.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. We're not doing anything special for our 200th episode. Maybe we will mark it at some point down the line. I think maybe episode 213 we'll organise a celebration. That's probably how long it'll take me to figure something out. But in the meantime, we are going to be talking about the only thing anyone's been talking about this week, which is Russia's invasion of Ukraine and all the things that are going on. I mean, one of the hazards of doing this is it is Sunday, the 27th of February, and things are changing very rapidly. So it's very possible.
Surprise. Putin's invasion force is not waiting for us to catch up.
I mean, he did time his invasion for our 200th episode, and we are grateful for that. But other than that, he's not been particularly accommodating, I think it's fair to say. So anything that we say, aside from just possibly being wrong anyway, is liable to change over the coming days. So that's our upfront health warning for our Ukraine topic, which will be the first thing that we're talking about. Jazza, what else are we going to be discussing towards the end of this episode?
We are going to tag a couple of things on towards the end, because other stuff is going to be, it has been happening in the world, and it is important to kind of like keep broadly abreast of them, to be fair, because otherwise stuff happens and then it's a shock further down the line. Boris Johnson's government have decided to impose a necessity of passing GCSE maths and English in order to qualify for student loans. I don't quite. It's difficult to understand because now they use the numbering system to grade GCSEs.
I was about to say exactly the same thing, which I think shows our age, apart from anything else.
Yes.
So I think a 4 is a C, which in old money was a pass, and I think 9 is like an A star, I think.
Okay.
But adding to the confusion, A levels are still graded on an alphabetical basis.
Right.
At least that's what I was picking up from the reading I was doing. The whole like numbering thing kind of passed me by. I don't really see what the point was. I still don't see what the point is. But it has.
Because it means that you can keep adding numbers. Is why. So that as grade inflation inevitably happens, you can start adding a 10. It's like, because once you've gotten to A star, it does get ridiculous when you start adding a double star. There's not really any way you can go from there, is there?
That does make sense. Although, you know.
But it makes it harder for anybody over the age of like 25 to understand anyone's GCSE results.
Yeah, I think it's an old money, new money problem, really. But we are going to be talking about what impact the government's proposals will have on university intakes, how it's going to disproportionately impact different groups of people as well, and whether we think it's a good or bad idea. So Stay tuned for that. And for this final topic, which I'm not disowning this topic, but it was Jazz's suggestion, as I think will become evident when we say what it is. So entertainers, Ant and Deck, formerly of, they used to do that Pokemon show on Saturday mornings.
It wasn't a Pokemon show. It was SMTV Live with Kat Deeley, and they used to do sketches in the run when they did the continuity between shows. So when they were showing the original Pokemon series, they would dress up as Misty and Ash.
Yeah, that's the only thing I remember, really, is the Pokemon link, I'm afraid. So again, showing our age.
But... ironically, we're doing drag then. Ant used to dress up as Misty. That is an old reference.
That is a very old reference. But they appeared on Saturday Night Takeaway, which is the regular Saturday night show, dressed in drag, literally. And Jazza thinks this is a very good thing, don't you, Jazza?
Yeah, I think so.
You think it's a positive message to queer children out there, or people who are interested in drag? Yeah, no?
I think it is more impactful for the fact that it was being put into living rooms of people who would otherwise never encounter the performance of drag. I don't want to spoil too much of my opinion, but that is going to be a nice little soft cherry on top of an otherwise very hard episode.
Yeah, I think it will be. So, you know, starting with war, going on to education, and ending in light entertainment. It's a classic format for us, I think.
Right. Excellent. Shall we beg for money and then go into the actual episode?
I think so, yes.
Very exciting.
If you've been enjoying listening to the Right Dishonourable podcast and want to get a little bit extra from us, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable and access a host of bonus episodes which are released after every full episode is put out. In recent weeks, we've discussed the New Zealand smoking ban, proportional representation, a favourite of ours, and Facebook's Metaverse project. So if you want to listen to the back catalogue of bonus content, go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable and you'll see all the sign-up details there. Thank you to our existing patrons, Eternal Elf, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, Gia Carney, Ilona Domkina, John O, Marlene, Matt, Michael Costa, Nick Webb, and Seb Kales. Jazza, when you woke up this morning, were you expecting to be threatened with nuclear annihilation?
Considering the last few days, it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility.
It's a very cool response.
Yeah, I was when the initial invasion started, I was still isolating from having COVID, therefore spent more time watching BBC News, like rolling 24-hour news, than I probably should have, and so have thought about very little else in the past week. I think last episode, actually, we talked about how distant everything felt and how I, like, wasn't really engaging very much with the threat of troops, of Russian troops on the Ukrainian border with Russia and the Ukrainian border with Belarus, because it felt out of hand and far away and all of those kinds of things. Mm. Well, watch me get slapped around the face with a wet kipper by an actual invasion, and then very promptly being told by the BBC how serious this all was. And I was like, oh, maybe I should pay attention. That's a very good point. Thank you very much, Nick Robinson. Yes, it should be pronounced Kiev.
Are we pronouncing it Kiev or Kiev?
Kiev. When a nation, or when people from a nation say, can you stop calling it Kiev? Because that's what the people... you call it that because of the people invading us. I'll at least try. You know what I mean? I'm gonna start calling it Kiev. You can do whatever you want, Jimmy, as always.
I think Kiev is too baked into my mind now.
Is it? It's only baked into your mind because of the chicken. You know that.
I knew you were gonna bring up the chicken, and that is definitely one of the reasons why it's baked into my mind. I mean, it's also in the last couple of years, last 5 years, the Czech Republic requested
it's called Czechia.
English, yeah, English-speaking countries refer to it as Czechia, which I think does look like it's a pleasing-sounding name, and it's more consistent with its neighbours. So there's a lot to be said for Czechia, but it's not worked for me. Like, I still have to perform like the if I see it on a map, I'm like, oh, the Czech Republic, even if it says Czechia, like because I think mm-hmm. Google Maps does that. And
I think Turkey has also requested to not be called Turkey anymore and to be called Turkia or something, which is closer to the Turkish to its Turkish name because it doesn't want to be associated with the animal anymore. And I think broadly that is a something that we should try to do. If a country is like, I'm all for us having regional differences in what we call cities and countries and stuff like that. I think that that's fine, says the guy who always pronounces Chinese cities properly.
It's kind of inconsistent though, because I mean, if you say Peking rather than Beijing, you sound like a dick, like you're trying to make a point about it, for instance. But I think a lot of this stuff is convention, like the whole the Ukraine versus Ukraine argument. When people say the Ukraine, I don't think they mean anything like derogatory about it. It's habit, right? So,
but if people do ask, can you call us this, or can you call this this? I'm like, okay, fine.
I don't know, because if Germany said, can you call us Deutschland, please? Because that's how we refer to our country as. I'd be like, no, I can't. Like that would be too much, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to be inconsistent and stick with Kiev, but still say Ukraine rather than the Ukraine. I'm glad that we've sorted that out at the top of the podcast.
That is obviously the most important thing that has come out of the last week. Yeah.
But I suppose it does say what this conflict is about, really, is that Ukraine wants to be independent and Russia would not like it to be independent. So
hold on. Ukraine is independent and recognized by Russia as independent, and there have been treaties signed by multiple parties, including Russia, that have that claim to respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine as it stood in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed and Ukraine got its independence. I know that you don't think that Russia has a claim to Ukraine, Jimmy. I'm just making a moot point.
I mean, in practice, Ukraine for the past 8 years has been occupying Crimea, which most countries internationally still consider to be Ukrainian territory.
Russia has been occupying
Russia. Crimea. Yeah, sorry, Russia has been occupying Crimea,
and there has been conflict in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Donetsk.
Donetsk and Luhansk.
Donetsk, and yes, those ones.
I mean, actually, Russian troops have been stationed there for much of the past 8 years, either in unofficial guise as the Little Green Men, who don't wear Russian-marked uniforms, and also more recently as actual soldiers who do wear Russian uniforms. So, you know, covertly and then overtly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the independence in a real sense of Ukraine has been contested since the 2014 annexation of Crimea by Russia. Mm-hmm. But I do take your point that everyone does, from a legal perspective, consider Ukraine to be independent. But this war will actually decide whether that is in practice the case, I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most striking thing, actually, because the warnings of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, I mean, they've been going on a quieter basis for, you know, much of the last 8 years. But in around December time, the US and UK intelligence agencies really started to say, oh, we think this is going to happen in February. There's a huge build up of forces on the border between Russia and Ukraine. One thing that actually I found surprising is that I thought this was going to happen because on all the news sources I was reading, it seemed to say, oh yes, this is going to happen. But I only found out after the invasion started that there were quite a few people who disputed the likelihood of this happening. People on particularly the far left of British politics. And, you know,
they've not come out with this very good, have they?
No, the Stop the War Coalition type people
who are now being told to leave, stop the war. This is like, this is the most uninteresting thing about the Ukraine thing, but of course my Twitter feed is quite obsessed with it. The fact that Keir Starmer said that you have to leave the Stop the War coalition, who are anti, who aren't pro-Russian, but are anti-NATO.
They're anti-Western, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, and include the likes of Diane Abbott and Jeremy Corbyn, etc.
So he told Labour MPs that they need to distance themselves from Stop the War, and they need to also not, you know, back off from claims that this was a war that was provoked by NATO aggression rather than Russian aggression. So he's basically telling his MPs that they need to fall in line with him rather than dissent from his position.
I don't think it's going to be very surprising to anyone in our audience that we think that that's probably a good thing. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Right,
Jimmy?
Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate. I do agree with that. I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Being silly.
So, you know, somebody needs to. Obviously, the question in any political party, which will inevitably end up being a coalition of views, is which views you allow in the broad church and which views you exclude from the broad church. And I mean, one of the reasons that I really, really dislike Jeremy Corbyn as a politician is that I think his foreign policy views were of the Stop the War coalition, of which he was a chair at some point. They were very anti-Western. He tended to side with Western enemies in disputes. So, you know, infamously, he was at a reflaying for the Black September attackers who attacked the Israeli athletes in Munich, which some people still deny took place. I'm aware of. If you bring it up on Twitter,
there are photos.
Yeah, there are photos of it happening. I don't think it, you know, he obviously, they tried to spin it at the time that it was a misrepresentation, and the fact that the photos originally appeared in the Daily Mail made some people dismissive of them. But I think it was of a piece with his general stance anyway. And I think it's probably the worst part about the far left in Britain, I think, is that they take those views. And I don't think it's merely about being kind of anti-patriotic. So you can, obviously, people should be free to criticize the actions of their governments in terms of foreign policy. You should allow for that. But I think what this particular conflict is so stark, it's so obviously that Russia is trying to violate the the independence and the self-determination of Ukraine. Anybody who kind of backslides on that, I think, in a serious way, you're allowed to make criticism, and I guess there's a question of where the line goes. But if you're saying this is all NATO's fault and actually we should not oppose and criticize Russia in its behavior, I think that is a problem. But so, you know, I personally wouldn't want to vote for a party with a large contingent of MPs who felt that way. So I think there's an electoral barrier there, apart from, you know, the morals of it. I think Keir Starmer is justified in that sense to make the demands he's made, really, on those MPs.
I'll be honest, I have wondered the relevance of an alliance like NATO in kind of like recent years, maybe even like recent decades, where most of our wars were in the Middle East, where there was constant talk of a Pacific threat with China on the board. But this really had... I mean, people are genuinely shocked that there has been an invasion of a country. Like, reports say, like, over 100, maybe even several hundred civilians have already died in the last few days of fighting since the actual invasion, since troops entered Ukraine. It's really depressing. It feels so archaic. It feels like stuff that we learnt about in books. Like, Boris Johnson, there's videos of Boris Johnson being kind of like giving evidence at select committees about decisions of reducing the funding for troops, and reducing our army and armed forces to its smallest size in, I think, over a century. And it that feels like a really, like, at the time, it actually probably makes sense to, like, focus on cyber and misinformation and blah, 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 and all of that kind of stuff. But all of a sudden, it makes total sense for us to have an active military and at least resource it. And, like, obviously, not expecting any NATO forces to be on the ground in Ukraine, but for there to at least be a show of force on the borders that NATO countries have with Russia.
I think, like, for example, the video you're referring to specifically is about, I think it's Boris Johnson who says this, who says that tank battles are no longer relevant to modern warfare.
Or tank battles going through the streets of Europe or something like that are no longer relevant. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously does look foolish in hindsight. I would say,
But I think at the time it was normal. Like, I don't think there were many people who would have disagreed with that. Maybe I'm just...
No, I think there were. I think there are military analysts who would have disagreed with that. I think there's an open question as to whether Britain is best placed to provide that kind of tank capacity or capabilities. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, where there's things that we're generally better at. Things like, you know, special forces capabilities and that kind of thing. There's things that we already are quite good at, that in the context of NATO, it doesn't make sense for Britain to specialise in everything and to provide a full spectrum of capabilities, I would argue, anyway. So I think there are countries that are probably better placed to provide that kind of, those kind of land forces, countries that actually are more exposed to Russia, basically, you know, countries like Germany or Poland, for example, and then Britain can do other things, and hopefully the spectrum of capabilities can be covered by multiple countries rather than one. But yeah, it does. I guess for somebody who doesn't follow military affairs so closely, I mean, I don't follow it that closely, but it is a shock to see tank battles, you know, to see tanks going into European cities.
To see 18,000 Kalashnikov rifles handed out to anybody who will take them in, like, Ukrainian cities. That's crazy. I don't know what else to say to that. Like, that's absolutely insane. I don't know. It's really difficult to not see the reporting from Ukraine, from the people who are there at the moment, and not be incredibly impressed with them. Not to sound like a propaganda machine, but, like, people who are just, like, very stoically, yeah, I'm gonna stay and fight one of the largest armies in the world.
Yeah, but one of the interesting things is that Russia has not fared very well in these early days. I mean, I don't.
Or think... not as well as was apparently expected. Like, they still have only taken one city. Is that correct?
I don't know if they've taken... I can't remember the name of it, but I think they have taken one.
The second city in Ukraine?
Kharkiv is actually still under the control of Ukraine.
Okay.
And Kiev, mm-hmm. has so far managed to defend itself as well. At the time of discussion, I think I read somewhere the expectation, at least by some Russian military people, was that the country would be under occupation in about 2 days, and we're now on day four, I think, of the invasion, and it has made some progress. It's made some inroads into the country, but it's been I think Russia is surprised by the effectiveness of Ukrainian resistance.
And it has potential problems for Russia, especially. I mean, we've seen not only many protests across Europe, but the significant kind of, like, manifestations have been the ones within Russia. In St. Petersburg and Moscow are the only ones that I've actually kind of, like, seen and known that it's from there. But apparently across 50 cities in Russia, there have been some kind of manifestations, thousands of arrests. The Russian people broadly are not on side with this war, it seems like.
It does seem that way. I think the only thing that I wonder is that obviously Western militaries and governments are also trying to be...
We have a propaganda machine as well.
Yeah, they're trying to be specific with the information they give to us. So I'm not saying that it, I think I'm sure it's true that there have been protests because that's been reported by independent media and all that sort of thing. I think it's probably a little bit difficult to gauge the extent of disquiet, but it definitely seems as though it's not proving a particularly popular war, especially compared to like the Georgian campaign earlier in Putin's tenure.
And the longer it goes on, the more likely it is for there to be divergence from the Kremlin's line, be that kind of like the ability of, because there's a large Russian-speaking population in Ukraine, the ability of them being able to kind of like communicate with Russians. It was been really interesting seeing some of the interactions that Russian troops have had with Ukrainians as they've invaded Ukraine, because those Russian troops, because there's conscription in Russia, and a lot of these young men are not going to be ideologues of the Kremlin. They're there because they have to be. And the potential for there being kind of like a I'm being too hopeful, but the potential for there to be a realization that the narrative of, oh, this is a liberation of the Russian Ukrainians, that bubble can, the longer this goes on, the easier it is to pop not necessarily pop that bubble, but ease some of the air out of that bubble.
Yeah, because the propaganda that Putin was giving to Russians, I think this was touched on in his like invasion announcement address as well, is that the Russians are there to purge the Ukrainian government of the neo-Nazis that run it and install a new regime, and to demilitarize Ukraine. I mean, he's made out that Ukraine is a threat to Russia.
He said that there's been genocides in the eastern regions of Ukraine. Also, the irony of him calling the Ukrainian government Nazis, where their president Zelensky is a Jewish Russian, like ethnically Jewish Russian.
Well, he's a Russian speaker, isn't he? I don't know. Would he
ethnically? Yeah, he's from Russian stock, I believe, anyway.
Oh, okay, yeah. So Zelensky's actually a really interesting guy. Probably most listeners are aware that he's a former stand-up comedian, and that he played a school teacher who ends up becoming president in a TV show before he became president.
And he named his political party after the name of the show.
Oh, right, I didn't know that, actually. I mean, he's in the last couple of days, he's come out of this quite well because he stayed in Kiev despite being offered evacuation by the Americans, and he seems like quite a heroic figure. I was reading this profile in the Times, which I thought was just quite interesting as a balance to that some of Zelensky's backers are actually quite anti-American and pro-Russian in their in their sentiment, which I guess is interesting anyway. You know, given that you'd imagine that Putin would have been more likely to invade if somebody had been in power who was much more vehemently anti-Russian than Zelensky seems to be. But actually, some people have criticized him for not taking the warnings of invasion seriously enough in the days that led up to it.
He was trying to downplay quite a lot of the concerns that were being raised by NATO allies, right?
Yeah, well, I guess you can question whether he was trying to keep calm for the sake of morale in Ukraine, and you know, that probably a discrepancy between what he actually thought and what he was saying, which would be normal. But I think he's a slightly more complicated figure than is sometimes being portrayed, at least in terms of the stuff.
He was not only a comedian; he was a TV producer. What has been really clear to me is how good he and his speechwriters and his propagandists have been at kind of like framing him and making sure that he looks really great, continues to make sure that Ukrainians are feel like they should be fighting, inviting foreigners to come and fight alongside Ukrainians as well to defend their country. It's been very effective wartime communications.
So this is a question that's popped up, which I think is quite fun. an otherwise very dark topic, but
be careful with your adjectives, Jimmy.
of recent British prime ministers and leading politicians, who among them can you imagine staying behind in London in the wake of a foreign invasion of this magnitude? Not Boris Johnson, I would suggest.
No, just to knock that one out quite quickly.
Yeah, I think that has to be done.
I reckon the ones that history looks more favourably on, so the Theresa Mays and the Gordon Browns. I reckon they would stay. Cameron, nah, he's out.
I think Tony Blair would stay. Actually.
I think Tony Blair would probably stay.
Yeah,
he'd love that. He's got a Messiah complex, though.
So. He does. Yeah, he definitely has a Messiah complex. I think that would suit him in a way.
That was a fun game. I did enjoy that. You're right. That was fun.
Something else. I think one of the last things I want to touch on.
John Major and Thatcher would also stay. I think.
So actually, most of them then is what you're saying.
Actually, most of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's only not Bojo and Cameron.
Yeah. Maybe we've slighted the honour of David Cameron there.
He looks like a squeaky balloon. He's not going to be any useful in a conflict, is he?
Yeah, I think I think Gordon Brown's temperament.
Whereas Theresa May with a Kalashnikov, I can believe.
Maybe a leopard skin print on the Kalashnikov.
Fuck yes.
But so the last thing I wanted to pick up on before we move on to even more light-hearted topics than that is the effect it's had on European politics. I think has been quite interesting, and Germany's response has been the most interesting.
In terms of the shift,
very reluctant to halt the Nord Stream gas project, Nord Stream 2, I should say.
And also to halt SWIFT, to expel Russia from SWIFT or some Russian firms from SWIFT.
Yeah, so the SWIFT payment system initially...
Can you explain that? You're clever.
So as a former reporter on payments regulation, I should be able to explain in detail what SWIFT does.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm not able to.
It's basically the infrastructure. It's the system on which payments between different countries happens.
Well, I don't think the payments do happen. I think it's a sort of notification. It's a messaging system to say that this payment needs to. But I mean, there's a whole it's way more complicated when you pay money from bank A to bank B than just shifting that money, because there's a whole series of processes. And what tends to happen is that you get a lot of payments queued up to be sent, and then between different banks you have a settling process whereby. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the case that I'm sending money to bank A, and then bank A is sending money, bank B is sending money to bank C, and so on. It's more like you queue up these different requests, and then you sort of sort them out at the end of it, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a very crude way of putting it.
Oh, see, that was actually more information than I was thinking. Good. Yeah.
No, yeah. So good. I don't, as far as I'm aware, SWIFT is just, part of the notification thing. I don't think it's involved in the settling. Google that in the background for a second.
Mm-hmm. But criticism of removing stuff from SWIFT was the fact that there was going to be huge collateral for Western allies as well, for their abilities to be able to procure from Russia, Germany, for example, that relies, I believe, on 2/3 of its gas coming from Russian providers. There was also the worry that expelling Russia from SWIFT was then going to force them into, I believe it's SIPS, which is the Chinese version of SWIFT, and therefore would reduce the reliance of Russia on dollar, and then maybe have them using renminbi a little bit more, which obviously favours China. They also created their own version of SWIFT, which is the SPFS, because frankly they invaded Crimea 6 years ago and saw this coming.
Yeah, I guess.
And so there were worries about how effective booting them out of SWIFT was going to be.
I think the intention generally, and I did look it up and I was right, so I am great.
Good job. You are.
But memory is clearly better than I thought it would be. The general intention of all of these sanctions is to isolate Russia from, I think, particularly the Western economy. But, you know, effectively, that doesn't mean isolating them from the greater global infrastructure around trading and economics and all the rest of it. So, the points about Russia just switching to other systems, which I you know, they obviously will do. I still think it's a good thing to be excluding Russia from the SWIFT system and be implementing a lot of these other sanctions.
I saw, was it the New York Times? I think it was the New York Times suggesting that booting them out of SWIFT was going to push them into the hands of China and the system that China uses, for example, shrinking them, but also crypto. And I think that I'm convinced that they only put that in the title for clickbait reasons, because I'm pretty sure that that's not going to be how Russian banks are going to be doing international transfers.
I was vaguely reading that in the wake of the Russian invasion, what you tend to see in any crisis is that people with money will start investing it in very stable assets. So gold is the most famous one, is that money will rush to the sort of things that are considered the best quality assets that have the least volatility in terms of price. And you didn't see that in crypto, I don't think, or at least those were the headlines I was reading. And some people did see this as a demonstration that cryptocurrencies are not well placed to be the kind of those kind of assets that rally during times of crisis, basically, that they're too volatile and untrusted for that to be the case.
What a shame. All of the NFT Twitter bros. R.I.P. There was also a significant change in Germany's policy. So eventually they caved and Russia has been booted out of SWIFT and they cancelled the Nord Stream pipeline, at least temporarily. But Germany has also decided, because it previously had a policy that any weapons or kind of like planes or anything that were produced in Germany were not allowed to be deployed to active military regions. And that was affecting some, I believe, Dutch, I can't remember, resources and Estonian resources that were originally produced in Germany. And Germany also was only sending, like, helmets to Ukraine. And the new Chancellor, Scholz, who I always have to look up what his name is, because he's not quite at the level of Merkel yet, is he?
He's been in the job like 2 weeks.
Bless him. But he's very qualified, though. He's been helping to run the show for a while. Said that there's been a big kind of like there's a necessary policy shift for Germany and is now allowing for there to be arms and kind of like other such things, arms deployed to
lethal aid rather than
aid. That is they've been allowing lethal aid to now be given to Ukraine so that it can defend itself against the Russian troops.
I think since World War II, and for entirely understandable reasons, both Germany and its neighbours have been nervous about any kind of German military activity. To put it very mildly, in cases like this, it can be the cause of some frustration that the biggest economy in Europe is not necessarily willing to pitch in terms of peacekeeping or military aid or what have you. And it has been a serious limitation in terms of German foreign policy. So this is a huge shift, really. I mean, it's in a way, you might say it's not entirely a positive one, but just because there always will be fears about German dominance. I'm not talking military terms, but just in terms of general political heft and what have you. But I think this will be, it's always dangerous to guess what the history books will say, but it feels like this will be a major kind of turning point in terms of how European politics functions. And it's a reminder that history's not ended, to raise that cliche again.
Shut up.
Yeah.
There's one more thing. Back to us. Back to the UK.
Go on then.
There have been, I think it's over 300,000 at this point, people leaving Ukraine as refugees. Most of them bleeding through into Romania and Poland, which border the west of Ukraine. There have been calls for the UK to remove as many barriers as possible to Ukrainians trying to flee the country and come to the UK. Mm. There was a very tasteless tweet from, what was his name? Kevin Foster, who is an immigrations minister, saying that, well, you might be a refugee, but you can apply to pick vegetables, and that'll basically be just as good as applying as a refugee to the UK if you're Ukrainian.
I think the Home Office tweeted something similar as well,
really?
Clarifying the policy towards Ukrainian refugees.
Oh, love that. Well, apparently the tweet's now been removed, and Liz Truss looked very stern about it on television this morning. I'm sure just before she posed in front of the Ukrainian and the Union Jack, the Ukrainian flag and the Union Jack.
I'm looking at that photo right here in the background. Yeah,
I've enjoyed the dragging that she's had. What's taking them so long to come to some kind of a solution? All we had from her was, we are looking at seriously at solutions to the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Surely it's not numbers.
I'd have thought it was numbers, don't you think? Like they're trying to work out how loosely to put the regulations in order to ensure not too many people
disincentivize people from coming. I hate our government's policy towards refugees. I find it intensely embarrassing, especially the amount of bullshit that we... There's some stuff that we were fed at school that I kind of like, that I quite liked, you know. Beyond the, we gave India railways, etc. bullshit. Oh, Empire was really good. Everyone really liked it, actually. Shit. There were some things that I learned at school that I was actually quite proud of. Like, for example, accepting many refugees fleeing Nazi Germany is a huge part of our national myth. And they're just shitting all over it. And I find it... It makes me angry.
I mean, in their defence, they were pretty generous with the offer to people from Hong Kong. So I don't think it's entirely consistent, basically.
Mm.
I think we should take our fair share from Ukraine, but how that actually pans out in practice, I don't know. I think it's more difficult than just saying, oh, we're going to remove restrictions from anybody with a Ukrainian passport or whatever. I think there's other provisions and stuff that have to be put in place. So I don't think it's something that can be turned on a sixpence, as it were. Mm-hmm. But I think it's right that it was obvious as soon as those tweets came out with saying, you know, you can apply to pick fruit and we'll let you come over here. It was fairly obvious that policy wasn't going to be acceptable in the long run. So,
and yet it was tweeted.
Well, this is still Boris Johnson's government, right? So, occasionally they get to the right solution, having exhausted all the other ones.
Yeah, he was ambushed by a cake. Anyway, anything else about Ukraine?
I don't think so. I think we can move to a slightly more lighthearted topic of grades and university loans.
Making sure that underprivileged and underprivileged people don't go to university. As somebody who doesn't go to university, who never went to university, Jimmy, can you speak for the... What percentage is it? What percentage do you speak for?
I think it's over half. I think it is a majority, but some of that is historic, isn't it? The intake is about half of young people go to university these days.
I think it's a little bit it's lower than
is
that.
It's slightly lower.
Yeah, it was at a peak of about 50% under New Labour, and that's dropped, I think, since then. Although it's one of the highest number of applications in the last year or so. I can't remember the numbers. Do you think that this is just a load of overeducated twats worried that they're not going to be able to get their McDonald's studies degrees?
white light. Can't believe you used the Mickey Mouse cliche. That was shocking. So I do kind of, so my main criticism of university is that I think that I don't think it actually gives people, I don't think it gives a lot of people any discernible skills that are useful in the job market. I think it is quite an expensive signaling process by which you can say, well, I've got an English degree from Cambridge, therefore I'm quite smart, so I can now go and join the civil service. And I think if that's what it achieves from an employment perspective, it's incredibly inefficient, and I think that we could do something better. And also, I also think that for people who, who are not academic, and who don't necessarily thrive in a university environment, I think it disadvantages them in quite obvious ways. And I think that there's probably some people that would be
You
quite
mean
good.
the overall system of valuing a university degree?
Yeah, in terms of how it works in employment. So that's my sort of upfront criticism about this. But I think the trouble is that going to university is seen as so widely desirable by the majority of people, and it's seen as an aspirational thing. Most people, I mean, I think a lot of people share my skepticism about the actual utility of the knowledge gained while studying for a degree, but a lot of people value the experience, and it's a major sort of class divider between people who go to university and people who don't go to university. So it's obviously a huge minefield here. And
I think one of it, just to add on to that
yeah.
super quickly, I think one of the major things where I don't think it's necessarily very efficient at this or actually like representative of what's happening, but at least for me, I was the first person in my family to go to university, and the sending and me going to university was the clearest like way to show of my parents of like, well, you have to go to university because it was the way that you ended up making sure that you were doing better than your parents, that you had better opportunities than your parents. And I think that I agree with you that there is only a certain amount of truth to that, especially the number of people who go to university now versus when my parents were at school is obviously very different. It's not necessarily representative of the kind of lifestyle that they were expecting when they were at school, and didn't go to university. But it is very difficult to disentangle at least that perception and that desire of families to send their kids to higher education.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult. And I mean, part of this proposal, I mean, I think the main point of this proposal is to limit university numbers, the number of people going to university, and in doing so, encourage more people into
Apprenticeships.
apprenticeships, like more practical courses, courses that, because specifically this, I mean, these kind of reforms, because it's part of a wider bill of reforms, is to try and, I mean, the way the government phrases it is to try and tackle courses that don't offer good value for money because they don't end up in people being employed.
The Prime Minister literally went to school for classics. I guess to be fair, he uses it. He parrots a load of shit every now and again, doesn't he, in Latin, so.
It's probably one of the heaviest Latin users in British society, I would say,
Yeah,
outside of
outside the Vatican.
outside of the Vatican City. But I think my objection is not really where most people are coming at this from. The way these reforms work is that if you don't get a GCSE pass in English and maths or 2 E-grade A levels, then you're not going to be able to access a government-backed student loan. So you'd have
So
to.
up until this point, everybody the our student loans are not like normal loans. Basically, if you wanted a student loan and you had a place at a university, anybody was able to get it. There were no prerequisites to it. Everybody had access to it. Whereas this is now going to limit those who can get it to those who have passed maths and English and have A level stuff.
I mean, I guess the intention of this is to, I think what
To
they
make sure thick people don't like live off of our dollar, isn't it? And get drunk for 3 years.
I guess that is part of the attitude to it. I mean, some people would make the case that university education is a good in itself, and it doesn't really matter if it leads directly to employment opportunities. It's a good thing to, it's a good process to put people through, and it will expand their horizons, yada yada yada. I don't really believe that's the case, but that is an argument that is made by some people. I think most people are primarily interested in the sort of the long-term like job opportunities that it affords, and also the status thing and the aspirational thing you were talking about as well. I think that's really what drives university attendance. It's those sort of attitudes. I mean, the net effect of this is obviously going to be to disadvantage people who are from poorer backgrounds, but that's the net effect of quite a lot of the way our education system works. That's kind of a feature of all the different bits of it, I would say.
Also people with learning difficulties who aren't able to access resources to help them get through the exam system. People with like dyslexia and dyscalculia are going to be hugely affected by this. And actually I live with somebody who now has a doctorate and lectures at LSE. She would not have gone to university if this were the policy at the time. She failed her GCSEs.
Right.
And that's, I'll be honest, that's enough for me to think that this is ridiculous. But there was also internal studies from, or a report, an internal report from the Ministry of Education that showed that this would disproportionately affect people from disadvantaged backgrounds. And there seems to be no attempt to, from what I have read anyway, there seems to be no attempt to correct for that. In any way, shape, or form. They're like, oh yeah, this is going to disadvantage, this is going to mean that people who otherwise would have gone to university and been able to improve their life prospects won't be able to go now.
I mean, if your aim is
to
reduce the taxpayer burden regarding university spending, so if you're trying to cut down the amount that taxpayers pay, These reforms will probably do that. I think that's probably something that they will achieve. Right?
Fantastic.
It really comes down to that thing of, you know, do you think going to university is good in itself? Does it matter whether it leads to employment opportunities? Which is a question people will differ on.
I don't even actually really think that that's not where my mind is at the moment with this. Anyway, it's less about people. This stops people from going to university if they want to go to university. I think that there is a case to say that people shouldn't just go to university to do a McDonald's degree, for example.
So that is a view that you agree with, then?
Yeah, I think, yeah, broadly, like, you should go to university to expand your knowledge or to improve your job prospects. But the idea that somebody who has failed either maths or English then is not able to contribute to academia or to improve their job prospects beyond then having to go into something vocational is incredibly insulting to people who go through our education system, and is going to disproportionately affect people who are not able to afford to go to like private school like we did, or who are don't have access to the resources that some people with learning difficulties have. I didn't have proper dyslexia training like tutorials or anything until I got to university. Like I was always fine at school. Like I passed stuff. It was like I was fine. But I didn't encounter that actual support that I needed to be able to actually get as good as I did at academia until I was at uni, because those resources didn't exist even at a private school that I went to when I was younger. Again, Jimmy, as with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I am angry about it.
Would you say you're equally or more angry?
Interesting.
Or less? I guess that's possible.
I'll probably Ukraine, to be fair. Yeah.
Probably worse. Yeah.
I did have to think about it.
Yeah, I think we've said all that needs to be said, but I don't think any either.
This is worse than Theresa May trying to do grammar schools again.
Yeah,
because grammar schools at least are trying to lift people up in a bad and inefficient way, but it's at least trying to lift people up. This is actively trying to tell people to, oh no, just work the tills or something. There's nothing wrong with working the tills, but it's like, oh no, you stop there.
I mean, I think that we have reached a point where too many people are going to uni in the sense that there are those degrees that are not particularly useful or good for the
students. Do you think they still exist with the amount that people have to repay with student loans?
Yeah,
well, they've also increased the amount of time that you have to pay the student loan back as well.
Yeah, they are going to. So it used to be that if after 30 years you hadn't paid it back, the rest of your debt was wiped, and they're looking to extend that to 40 years, which will be, you know, the overwhelming majority of people's working lives, and they're reducing the threshold at which the repayments, the salary threshold at which the repayments come back apply as well. I think, you know, that so the reason I said that there are degrees that aren't particularly worth very much is that there's still, I haven't got the figure in front of me, there's still a reasonable proportion of people that don't have a graduate job 18 months after they leave university, which I think does suggest there is a problem. You could argue that maybe part of that problem is people going to university in, say, Liverpool, and then moving back to the town where they grew up, and those jobs aren't available. So there might be, I'm sure there's other factors that play into those figures. But I think there's a genuine problem in this country is that the Blair government was like, okay, we're going to increase attendance at universities. And I think that was done with good intentions. But I don't think I don't get the impression anyone in high up in politics has a good idea of where to go with the university system, like what it's for, what we're trying to achieve out of it. It just seems to be a kind of clusterfuck of reforms at the moment in terms of, you know, tuition fees and, you know, this particular reform that we're discussing. And you know, I obviously have a wider philosophical problem with the university system and how it translates into the jobs market, and I do think that is an issue. But it seems quite muddled to me at the moment, and I think this reform is going to contribute to that muddling.
Speaking of muddling
through this podcast, somehow.
muddling with gender, I guess. So Anton Deck, for anybody who. That was a very bad segue.
I could have given you a better verb to work with, I think.
You could have, you know. We didn't try.
Yeah.
Anton Deck are the biggest, most powerful presenters?
Most powerful.
In the UK? Powerful, yeah, I'm using power.
Powerful.
They are kind of like some of the most recognised individuals on British television, and are linked to ITV as a broadcaster exclusively. Right. They did a lovely musical number with the three winners of the three seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race, the Vivian, Lawrence Chaney, and Crystal Versace.
You're talking about the UK version of Drag Race.
Of course.
Yeah.
I'm not...
I'm just clarifying, Jazza.
We're on season 14 in the US. Thank you very much. Team Bosco, by the way.
I don't know what that means.
No, it's okay, you poor straight man. And Anton Deck performed in drag. Bless him, Ant, or as she was called on the night, Antoinette.
Lady Antoinette.
Lady Antoinette. And what was... Miss D...
Miss Donnelly.
Miss Donnelly was Deck. Ant can't walk in halls, bless him. But there was a really fantastic kind of like part of their show where they donned full drag. Breastplates, face, like makeup, heels, show outfits and everything, where they looked absolutely amazing and presented drag to an audience that I don't think would otherwise have encountered drag apart from when it was on primetime TV in the 90s with Lily Savage, which to be fair is a very different type of drag queen. This was a really big deal on gay Twitter, and I think it's a big deal thusly. One, because drag as an art form ended up in people's living rooms who wouldn't have otherwise engaged with it. And I love that. Bit of gender fuck.
You went a bit Bristolian there.
I did. And secondly, because Anton Deck took it seriously, they legitimately tried to kind of like be good in drag. It wasn't a joke. And I thought that was a really big deal. Like, it was presented as something fabulous, not as something to be laughed at. And I think that's a huge shift with gender performance that we've only seen very recently. Even 10 years ago, drag queens were often the butts of jokes. Even in queer spaces, they were the butts of jokes. And now it's being taken so seriously as an art form that the two most powerful, yes, powerful, presenters in UK media want to have a go. I thought it was brilliant.
I haven't seen it, I'm afraid, so I'll have to take your word.
It's literally a like 5-minute clip. You could have done some research, mate.
I read some articles about
so it. So disappointing.
That's my
answer to everything.
I would say so, yeah. Definitely. Sorry, I was distracted by a car, like playing its boombox outside my window, so I've slightly lost thread of the what I was going to say.
Anton Deck doing drag, very good thing in my opinion. What do you reckon? I bet you don't care. Do you not care?
Yeah, so when we were discussing this segment of the podcast, my initial objection was that I do not care, which I think is still true. But I did find a more substantial complaint from Camilla Long, writing for The Times, that I wanted to offer not as my opinion, Jazza, but as a counterpoint to your boosterism.
Why do you hate me?
Well, you know, this will be a very boring thing if you just say, oh, this is great, and I go, yeah, it's great, and then we just move on.
Excellent. End of the podcast. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Please support us on Patreon. We'll see you for episode 200. No? Okay. Go on, ruin my day.
So this complaint from Camilla Long echoes quite a common complaint about drag queens and drag culture. She uses this term "woman face" to describe. Uh-huh. Have you heard that term before? Uh-huh. I guess you know what it means instinctively. Anyway, that
go on, tell the people.
She describes. You know, doing drag as dressing up as a woman in order to mock women under the guise of entertainment. And she says, for every queer child who feels, quote, changed, end quote, for better or worse, by seeing two overexposed Geordies flog a charity single in clodding heels, there must be hundreds of little girls watching the hairy older men, stars of a show with 8 million viewers, horse around in plastic tits, and wonder if this is what everyone thinks a woman is. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, essentially she's saying that, you know, drag culture caricatures women and that it's not okay, Jazza. So what would you say to Camilla if she was her?
I am sure, I mean, in the broadness of the art form, there's some stand-up comedy, for example, that isn't in good taste,
right.
Is it? Mother-in-law jokes. Women aren't funny, etc., etc. There are going to be some drag queens that are maybe not celebrating femininity and are taking the mickey out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't what drag is like nowadays, I'll be completely honest. And anybody that, and it is a celebration of femininity and the femininity that so many queer people especially have felt they've had to repress because of the way that our society looks at people that are queer, gender non-conforming, etc. There are also a myriad of AFAB queens, so assigned female at birth queens, cis women who perform in drag.
Right.
We have covered Victoria Scone on this podcast at my request before.
We have.
And you were similarly disinterested. drag is not just men prancing around in a breastplate. It is people freeing themselves from masculinity in many ways. In the way that we're talking about drag is kind of like people performing as queens. But I think that it is a willing misunderstanding of what drag is, or just ignorance of what drag is and how people approach it and what it does and what it represents.
Yeah, I agree.
Excellent. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Please join us for episode 201.
The only thing I will add is that I think there's a very long history in British comedy. I mean, the pantomime dame is kind of the obvious example of you know, men dressing up as women. And as you say, it's not always in perfect taste and it's not always respectful. But, you know, like Monty Python, loads of other like great comedians throughout the years have dressed up as women to make jokes and make fun of things and to, you know, play with ideas around gender and all that sort of thing. And I think to dismiss drag in the way that Camilla Long does is just bizarre in that context, given that history. So I think it's but you know, it's a complaint that you hear an awful lot from Derek.
TERFs.
Well, I didn't want to say, but you said it now, so I don't have to.
I did now.
So yeah, this has been the 200th episode of the Right Dishonorable podcast. We are still somehow going after, it's going on for 7 years, I think, now.
Oh my god, is it that long?
Started the audio edition of this.
Oh my god.
So yeah, getting quite long in the tooth. We're no longer the exciting young people we once were. We're now cruising towards middle age and irrelevance, if ever we were relevant.
Wow, what an inspiring speech to end on, Dewey. I'm sure people will want to support us on Patreon after hearing that.
Well, you know, they must.
The quality is only going to decrease as our enthusiasm continues to waver. Thank you so much for listening.
But in all seriousness, thanks to everyone who's listened to us at all over the past 7 years, particularly those who've been listening since the start, and do like get in touch if that's one of you, if you've been listening since episode one, that would be cool.
We'd love to hear from you on Twitter or via email or otherwise, and especially thank you, obviously, to the patrons as well, who help us with web hosting fees and all of that kind of stuff.
Indeed.
Because it does get expensive.
It's all right. We're doing fine, I think. It's not going to bankrupt us yet.
No. Feign poverty.
I mean, with these gas prices, who knows what's going to happen?
Okay, all of that gas that it takes for us to record this podcast.
This gas computer that I'm using. Really should upgrade at some point.
What steampunk universe are you living in Crystal Palace? My God.
An enjoyable one. It's got a great aesthetic.
Great, yeah. Everyone's wearing goggles and in Victorian garb. Anyway, all right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone. Toodaloo.